to be in orbit.
Welcome back to What It Means to Be Human. I'm your host, Dan Zetterstrom. In each episode, I explore profound questions and thought-provoking ideas with leading voices from around the world, from the depths of the ocean to the edges of the universe. Discover what connects us all and walk with us as we explore and redefine what it means to be human. And now to introduce my wonderful co-host so we can talk about the reaction to the launch, which was awesome. Roz, how you doing?
Hey, Dan, I'm good, considering, you know, it's been a little bit crazy this last few weeks. The launch was very exciting. There was a lot of comments and a lot of good energy online. And yeah, it was my big podcast debut, which is, it's a whole new world, Dan. What can I say? It's like a new universe for me, literally.
We've been overwhelmed with awesome comments, and the response to the show has been amazing. It seems a lot of you out there were dying for a space that was kind and compassionate and easygoing and cozy, and we are so stoked to try and provide that for you. This week, people have been listening to the Richard Hatem interview, which was awesome. Yesterday, I went to Washington, D.C., and actually saw Richard Hatem's show live in person. He was reading a episode of his podcast that will never be recorded. And so it was just awesome. Everyone was great. And also, as a little bonus, I don't know if anyone knows the podcast Astonishing Legends. They've been going for about, I want to say, like 10, 12 years now. And they are incredible. You know, they do five-part series on the Patterson-Gimlin Bigfoot movie and the Betsphere and stuff like that. And I personally consider it the podcast of record on so many different subjects. So Scott Philbrook from Astonishing Legends was there. So that was great to finally meet him. And it feels kind of like we launched the podcast and now I'm kind of getting into the podcast community.
Yeah.
It's real nice. But, you know, hi, if anyone's there and listening, I dropped something at some point and Richard was like, Dan Zetterstrom. And I was like, oh no, don't bring attention to me. So if anyone found this from that, hi, sorry for dropping the thing. And you were all awesome, especially the person that brought cupcakes for everyone. I thought that was very sweet. It was upstairs in a bookstore called Kramer's, which is kind of infamous. They do food and drink there. And yeah, it was wonderful. Very inviting.
But, oh, that's super cool. And that was in D.C., right? Like right in Washington, D.C.
It was, yeah. First time in D.C., seeing, you know, where they held the hearings recently and stuff like that, and seeing the Capitol and the buildings and, you know, just sensing the history and the presence there was amazing. But I wore a UFOs are real t-shirt and I got so many comments from people, not bad comments, all of them, like as I was riding past on a scooter, they'd yell, UFOs are real. And like the security guards at the Capitol would say like, oh, you missed the awesome hearing by a week. It was great. Not a single person called UFOs UAP though. They all called them UFOs, which I thought was telling and pretty cool.
That's interesting. It reminds me a little bit of when I ran the Disney marathon and I had Princess Leia buns on, not unlike my headphones right now. And as I was running through Disney, people would yell at me, Leia, as I ran by. So yeah, it's always cool to wear something that's a little bit eye-catching, especially in DC, because I mean, the hearings, everything that's been going on there recently, right?
Yeah.
So you were right in time, Dan. You were like, you know, you're part of the trend.
Yeah, exactly. like I said last time, I consider myself right in time for this, even though I was like a week late for the hearing, because I don't want to go and sit behind people that have been standing in line since midnight and, you know, just the whole bunch of smells that come with that that I don't want to be a part of. And then I wouldn't even be able to see. So yeah, stay at home, comfy, coffee.
I don't know. I think it would have been fun to watch the hearings and see you sitting in the background like James Fox and all those awesome folks. I would have been like, there's Dan and there's Dan and there's Dan. And actually David Grush too, like watching the hearings, seeing David Grush behind the Congress people there. That was really cool. That was cool.
You would have seen Grush and I like throwing, you know, sign language, coded language, and everyone would have been like, what the hell are they talking about?
Yeah.
Could have been great. But we are going to talk about the hearings today. We've also got some more things on the docket. We're going to be talking about UAP 23, the Brazilian hearing, Life on Mars. We're going to do a little kind of book club with Roz, with reading her books. And also, I guess we're going to talk about the rapture that did or didn't happen this week.
It could still happen today, couldn't it? I think it might.
Could have happened.
Yeah, maybe still.
Was I just so busy I missed it?
I thought it was like Tuesday or Wednesday, like 23rd Tuesday or 24th. It could happen right now while we're actually recording this, Dan. I don't know.
Man, They've been organizing the rapture for thousands of years and they can't even decide Tuesday or Wednesday. It's disappointing. Yeah, you just, the execution is lacking here, you know?
Yes, pick one day so everybody knows when to show up or knows when to sell their cars and their houses.
Yeah, can cancel my subscriptions, cancel my Disney Plus subscription on that day, you know?
Yeah, totally.
But first, we are going to dive in to the second episode of UFO or UF No. I hope you guys had fun with it last week. This week, it's a bit tougher. We're just going to show the video. We do have a little map because I think it's important to kind of see where I was when I took this. But this is a video that I took myself whilst I was out walking late at night on Barry Island in Wales.
I didn't know that. I didn't know this was an actual Dan video when you sent it to me.
Yeah.
Okay, amazing. Well, that makes it all the more intriguing. So a really great piece of listener feedback that I got on our first UFO or UF No was to describe it for the audience at home who may not have a screen.
Yes.
Dan. So I'll let you describe it. Okay, ready? Here we go.
So this is almost a pitch black frame if you're listening to audio only. There are two blue lights in the frame. One seems still and the other one is kind of moving around in the sky and then zipping down towards the other blue light. Oh. I was filming this on the coast. So I am looking out across the Bristol Channel, so Cornwall, so from South Wales to Cornwall. That is a really big gap. And you kind of get ships going up there and stuff like that. But this light is moving too fast to be a ship. It is in the air. There is some, what some people would describe as anomalous movement, I guess. And I thought it was a really cool video to show for this.
That's wild, Dan. They're like merging or something. It's like they come together, the two blue lights, and they kind of do this weird merging thing. I mean, am I allowed to give my opinion at this moment?
Yes, please do.
Okay. My opinion is that is UFO. That is definitely a UFO. Not a UFO, a UFO. That's
UFO.
Bananas. Yes, I think so. Yeah, that's my take.
So, If you are watching or listening, again, you've got the hour to do a little digging on this and to try and think about what it could be. But I'm excited to hear what people think. I think that's a really cool video. And we'll share a bit more at the end.
Mind-blowing.
So we're going to just jump into the hearings chat here. On September 9th, House Oversight and Reform Committee's Task Force on the Declassification of Federal Secrets, that's a tongue twister,
again,
held a hearing called Restoring Public Trust Through UAP Transparency and Whistleblower Protection.
Today, I want to state clearly that this is not science fiction or creating speculation. This is about national security, government accountability, and the American people's right to the truth. Do you solemnly swear?
We had Jeff Nucitelli, Chief Alexandra Wiggins. We had George Knapp, the great George Knapp. We had Dylan Borland, who I was really excited about in our previous episode to hear testify when we're doing our preview. And we also had Spielberger, who was from POGO, Project on Government Oversight. They deal with whistleblowers a lot and they try and, you know, make the organization independent because they believe that everything should be independent from government. You know, you can't criticize an organization you're a part of and expect it to be addressed properly. So we had those five people. And they all kind of opened with their witness statements and we had a good idea of, you know, who they are and what they were bringing to the clearing. I love that we could spot Matt Brown of Immaculate Constellation document fame in the audience there. Previous hearing, he wasn't mentioned. Well, when he was mentioned, he wasn't there at all. This hearing, he was in the seat. Is he going to be in the seat in the next hearing, Roz, do you think? Is he going to testify?
I think he's moving his way up. Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
He's getting closer. And we also had David Grush there, who reminded me of Captain America in Infinity War. You know, with the beard. He's looking grizzled and ready for action.
Very serious. Also noticed him like adjusting his badge. Like he was looking down at his badge and like making sure it was facing forward and stuff. He looked, it was really nice to see him there. I got to say, like after all of the, you know, negative publicity he got post hearing the first go around and all of that stuff, it's nice to see him like there kind of helping and being a part of the conversation from the other side. You know, I think that's really great.
Yeah, absolutely. And apparently he was instrumental in getting a lot of these witnesses on board. I read from our good friend Chris Sharp at the Liberation Times that he found that the congressional staffers were stopping Dylan testifying and they had to really push for him to be there. And eventually they overcome it. And, you know, he was there on the day, but there was pushback against Dylan even testifying, which is, it just raises your eyebrow. If there's nothing to see here, why are you messing with things like this, right?
Yeah, that's bizarre. That's crazy. Yeah. And Dylan was one of the most interesting, witnesses, I thought, but we'll get into it. We'll get into it. Do you want to move through them one by one? Do you want to start at the top and move down the aisle? How do you?
Yeah, let's do it.
So do this. Yeah,
we'll start with Jeffrey Nucitelli.
Thank you, Chairwoman Luna, Ranking Member Crockett.
A U.S. Air Force veteran who's gone public about a whole bunch of kind of mass UFO sightings at Vandenberg Air Force Base, where this massive red square-shaped UFO was observed over several days.
I'm here today because the American people have both the right and the responsibility to know the truth about unidentified aerial phenomenon.
This event was referenced by Ryan Graves when he testified at a previous hearing, so it's good to see that kind of follow-up. But he emphasized that he has three goals: to fund independent research into UAP, to end secrecy and overclassification, and to protect the witnesses, because by protecting them, we'll embolden others to come forward. And I think that's, in Dylan's testimony, he says directly that David Grush helped him get to a place where he could come testify. So it's real, you know, the more witnesses come forward, the more witnesses are going to come forward. We all embolden each other by talking about this stuff. So I was glad that he said that. Then we had Chief Alejandro Wiggins.
My name is Alejandro Wiggins. I'm an active duty U.S. Navy Operations Specialist, Senior Chief Petty Officer.
Yeah. Would you like to, you go ahead and talk about Chief Wiggins.
Oh, I mean, Chief Wiggins, he was great. I found his testimony was pretty short. I feel like because he is, currently on duty, right? He's still working in the military, that he was being very picky and very careful about what he was seeing, even more so, I think, than everybody else. The story about the orbs coming out of the ocean, right? We talked about this last episode, but like close to Catalina Island, right off the coast of California. I mean, that to me is, it's a hot spot, and it's mind blowing. I mean, to hear him describe it, they all are in formation and they're moving in formation. And, you know, again, he's very matter of fact and he's very careful about how he's describing it. And even when he was being pressed by one of the congressmen, to kind of give him more details.
So did you think what you were looking at was a weapons program that you were unaware of? Or did you think what you were looking at was obviously some extraterrestrial piece of technology?
Neither one of those crossed my mind. It was just...
How about now? What do you think it is now?
I'm not the expert.
Wiggins was a little bit cautious about saying what he thought it was and, just being delicate with it. So yeah, I thought he was great. Very, very credible, very intelligent. Excellent witness overall.
Yeah, I really enjoyed his testimony. And you're completely right. Like, he described things in a really clinical way. And for me, that's a bonus. I don't know how you feel about that, but I don't want someone sat in front of Congress going, UFOs are real. The Pleiadians are watching us right now. Here they live. And the Galactic Federation. I want people who are unbiased, who will just say what they saw. And I thought Chief Wiggins did that excellently. And like you said, he's still serving. And that's actually the first still serving whistleblower we've had at these hearings, which is amazing. Big development. So the goals that he spoke about were that he wanted people to know, service members to know, that reporting these things won't harm their career. That was a big theme of the day, repercussions for reporting. He also wanted technical summaries and metadata release with radar, because that will help with communications between departments and, possibly stop a really bad national security situation. Mm-hmm. And just to ensure a safe and effective pathway for whistleblowers. Mm-hmm. All very agreeable things so far, right? No one's saying, bring us the bodies. They're just saying, please protect us so we can talk about this. Like, this isn't okay.
Yeah.
And we had...
Oh, sorry. Just going to jump in for a sec. I was just going to say, you know, I do take a little bit, it's not that I disagree with what you're saying about people being unbiased. I think you're right. Like, we do want that unbiased perspective. But I felt like he could have been just a little more excited. I don't know. There was just like a bit of a flatness there where I was like, I'm not sure if he's taking this as seriously as everybody else. You know, not maybe seriously, but maybe he just, I don't know. The overall vibe I got from him was like, okay. You know?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so. I can see. Absolutely. You know, the other witnesses were a bit more bombastic, but he was just straight shooter down the middle. You know, but if I was watching like All the President's Men, that's the kind of testimony I would expect in something like that. But you're also right. Like, there's something palpable to it when, you know, Dylan gets talking about things and George Knapp gets talking about things. And there is a bias there, but the bias comes from a place of experience that they can talk about, right? But it's just not going to that place where, you know, in Independence Day, when they go underground and they see the scientists in the ship for the first time, the scientist is like, the ship just turned on. It's a very exciting time. And the president's just like, millions of people just died. Exciting isn't the word I'd use. It's like, we just don't want that, you know, that mad scientist like that. So then we had George Knapp, UAP journalist, long time, for decades.
This is a huge file. How in the world did you smuggle this out of Russia?
Carefully.
In your socks?
You know, I don't think I want to be really specific about it because I might have to go back there and get some more sometime. Although.
Okay.
And he was one of my highlights of this hearing. I thought he did excellently. He did not bite his tongue. He named names, which was amazing. He basically said, you know, this isn't a matter of faith. There's a paper trail here, and it goes all the way back to the 40s. We can prove categorically that someone in the US government is lying about this and impacting the conversation in a negative way. Which, again, like, that's something that people can grab onto, right? They can go to the FOIA reading room, they can look that up, and they can just raise an eyebrow. You don't have to believe in aliens or pretend to know where these things are from, because I don't think they do know. But I think it's important to realize that this, like you said, it's serious, and this is a very real thing.
Yes, George Knapp, of course, my favorite. I mean, you know, I already have expressed my love on our first episode, but, you know, I just felt like he was so in his element. He is so articulate. George Knapp has this ability to like pull information from the recesses of his memory and make it so present as though he's telling you the story in real time. You know, like when he's talking about the Russia documents and getting those out of Russia, and you feel like you're right there, like the way he tells the stories. I mean, I guess that's why he's such an amazing journalist. He's able to tell compelling stories, right? But when he speaks, you just feel like he's really, you know, walking you through it as it happened. And he's just so, it's almost like photographic memory, his ability to recall things and details and just, you know, bring them up kind of off the tip of his tongue. It's really unreal. And also the cool thing I found about George was that, you know, because he's not military and he hasn't worked within the government, he's able to bring a breadth of perspective to the topic.
Yes.
He's able to color it in for us and be very, like, you know, kind of clear about details that people who've worked within organizations, military, government can't be. So I really found his testimony to really fill in a lot of the blanks. And I'm sure that, you know, Congress enjoyed as well what he had to say and how much depth he could give.
What is, in your view, having investigated this issue for so many years, what is the long game with respect to disclosure of this information to the public? Because with the advent of essentially a video camera and a high megapixel phone in everybody's pocket, at some point, this information is going to be impossible to withhold from the public. What do you think is the long game here?
Well, the secret's out. I mean, how many videos have there been already? You know, videos that are leaked from within the military and intelligence agencies and contractors and sensor platforms, it's out there. But they have the high ground. The people that don't want us to take it seriously dismiss it, discredit the witnesses, come up with a cover story. I mean, it's been out there a long time. The public senses that it's real, and the people in authority dismiss them. It's a game that's been going on a long time, and I don't think they're ever going to release it. I think that there's an attitude among the people that have been involved in this for a long time that the public doesn't deserve to know, and that the public probably can't handle it, but they can.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, bottom line is George has never signed an NDA to deal with any of this stuff, as far as I know anyway. So he's a journalist, so we can talk about this stuff in a way that, you know, Dylan, for example, can't, or Lou Elizondo can't, because they signed an oath and the NDAs and stuff like that, and can literally be thrown in jail and the key can be thrown away on them. So we have all these different perspectives, but I think that's important why George was there. That's the reason he was there, right? Is to complement all of this, to go, yeah, these are just a bunch of experiences that people have had, but let's add the cherry on top and understand that this goes back decades and these aren't the first guys this has happened to. And it's really important. And also, you know, he spoke about Bigelow in the Bass days. You know, this is the OSAP era, pre-2010. Trying to set up a transfer of material from Lockheed. And when I say material, I mean exotic material, supposedly UFO material that they've had for decades, don't know what to do with, can't do anything with it. We're trying to give it to some scientists who really wanted to dig in on it. That was shut down by the CIA, we're told. So nothing came of it. But the proof is there. You know, the emails are there, the conversations are there about transferring that material. The Russia story, I absolutely loved when he said, you know, these were classified documents and it was just after the fall of the Soviet Union. So there was kind of a window where it was, you know, the Wild West or the Wild East. It depends on the map, I guess. But, you know, he had these classified documents and he was asked, how did you get them out of the country? And he said, well, only the front page was stamped classified. So I just tore the front page off and then just walked out with them.
Genius. Like, again, in the movie version of George Knapp, this is going to be a pivotal scene. Okay, tearing the pages off, putting it on a suitcase, absolutely. Throwing some caviar on top, as he said, throw a couple cans of caviar on there. Like, oh,
pouring
my
his
God.
Giant testicle in a wheelbarrow to get him through the airport. You know, he's just absurd. How many people would smuggle documents out of post-Soviet Russia in that way? And he says in the hearing, he said that he spoke to the people later that gave him these documents and many of them wouldn't talk to him at all. And the ones that did said, hey, George, you know, like, we're in trouble for doing that. Had it been 10 years ago, we would have been up against a firing squad for giving you those documents. So no more. Those documents were translated. They are available online. You know, they were submitted to the Congressional Record, so you can get them there now. And you can read them for yourself. You know, there are some crazy stories. Very much reflects the same kind of stories we hear in the USA. Planes being stalled that are chasing and firing at UFOs. Pilots being killed when they retaliated because, or when the UFOs retaliate because they fired on the UFOs. There's also a bunch of stuff about Lake Baikal, which is essentially a stupidly deep lake. And there are stories of like people going down into there and encountering lights and things like that. But that is actually in a region of Russia where the Dyatlov Pass incident happened as well. Those mountains are kind of like the Skinwalker Ranch of Russia. Weird stuff happens. And there might be some research stations underground and things like that. But the point is, no one talks about it. So we're just kind of left with these possibilities, kind of going, wow, you know, Dyatlov Pass, everyone knows that story of the hikers who in the middle of the night ran out of the tent, stripping their clothes off, and some were burnt and eaten. And, you know, there's so many explanations out there for it, but it's
so crazy.
Really intriguing, right? I'm going to switch the last two up a little bit. Spielberger from Project on Government Oversight testified last, but I'm going to switch in with Dylan just because that's the big kahuna of the hearing.
Yeah.
I think you both agree. So Spielberger, he had a good showing, you know.
Chairwoman Luna, Ranking Member Crockett, and Task Force members, thank you for the opportunity to testify here today about the importance of strengthening whistleblower protections, especially in the context of national security.
Again, very just the facts, man, but he really emphasized to Congress that we need to protect whistleblowers because all of what Congress does comes from whistleblowers telling them this program is spending too much, this program is doing something illegal. And he was citing some figures, some crazy figures of like 800 whistleblowers for one program that led to them, you know, bringing it to Congress and Congress shutting that down. So it's really important that we have that in place. He said, focus on the evidence, not the people. And I think that is, you know, it's like the little wink for the UFO community because all too much we focus on the people, I think.
Yeah, agreed. His testimony, I mean, I think you're right that each of these people was chosen for a reason. And it sounded like, I mean, from what I was able to understand, like Jeremy Corbell and David Grush both had a big hand in organizing this. So in terms of maybe who was presented, I think everybody there was kind of there for a reason and to give a different perspective. You know, I found Spielberger just to be a little on the dry side. You know, I'm not going to lie. I was tuning out a little bit listening to
it. He came across as like, I'm the paperwork guy. Like, my job isn't sexy. You're not going to enjoy it, but I get shit done.
That's right. And I kept saying to Dale, to my husband, I was like, is that his son sitting behind him? Because I swear his son was sitting right behind him during the whole testimony.
Anybody, did he just look like a mini him? I didn't spot that.
Yeah. Because I was like, he looks identical. So anybody going back and rewatching, let us know. Okay. Let us know in the comments.
Let's find out.
Was that his son sitting behind him? Because I think it was. That's what I kept focusing on.
A hybrid clone that was trying to take the attention. No, I'm kidding. We're not going down that road. Okay.
Younger,
Dylan Borland.
Younger. Yeah.
Still star of the show. This is Dylan, geospatial intelligence analyst for the United States Air Force, intelligence analyst for BAE Systems, and now works for Intrepid Solutions and Services, just doing geospatial analysis. Basically, anything that's in the sky, he analyzes and he propagates that information out to where it needs to go.
During the summer of 2012, my team was on standby for weather and I returned to my barracks on base. And at approximately 0130, I saw an approximately 100-foot equilateral triangle take off from near the NASA hangar on the base. The craft interfered with my telephone, did not have any sound, and the material it was made of appeared fluid or dynamic.
His testimony was that he saw a huge triangle silent hovering a few kind of meters off the ground and that it flew off after he saw it. He said that he doesn't think it was conventional because the triangle kind of manifested around one light as it approached him. So it was like an orb kind of changing into something. Or we could look at that as, you know, it was just dark and he couldn't see the rest of the craft until it kind of came closer. But I give him the ability to misspeak because he says that the edges were 90 degrees on a triangle, and that's not how triangles work. But it had corner lights and a light in the middle of like a classic, you know, triangular UFO. And he said that the surface of it was like lava or plasma or fluid going in and around the craft. He described it like a James Webb picture, I assume, of like the nebulas and stuff like that. And that has been in so many UFO sighting stories, whether it's something to do with a gravity bubble around the craft distorting it, or whether it's to do with the skin of the craft reacting with the environment and ablating and like burning off, so it's the constant reaction going and it looks to us like it's just alive. But we've heard this time and time again, and there are even some UFO photos that may or may not be hoaxes. We don't know. It's just one of those question mark ones where you can see like this orange glowing. It almost looks like, if you leave like the hob on too long and it becomes red hot, it looks like that. There are like white areas and like dark orange areas, and it looks like it's moving and flowing.
Yeah, that was his testimony. Was wild. His story was the one that I came away with going like, wow, that was. I feel like every congressional hearing, there's at least one of those moments. And for me, it was definitely his testimony. The way he described it, he's standing outside with smoke on the track. He's, you know, looking up at the sky. This thing approaches. Suddenly it's over him and it just kind of morphs into the triangle from a light. I mean, that whole scene is just playing out in my head like, wow, it's wild. And it reminded me, of course, of like the Belgian wave. I mean, all of these stories of like, these triangle craft, right? There's just been so many of these stories throughout history, throughout, ufology and people talking about them. It's to hear it again and just in such a clear, like he's standing, what did he say? It was like 100 feet above him. Is that what he said?
Yeah, really close.
So close that he's able to, 2 to 3 minutes, he said, like examine the skin of it and the plasma-like quality of it. And I mean, I just, like these stories to me are just mind-blowing because number one, they're all under oath anyway, right? So they're all standing there under oath and giving this testimony. But number two, like there's just no way that this didn't happen to this person, you know? So people who are skeptics, it's like when you hear these guys give their testimony, you're like, there's no way he's lying about this. Like, this actually happened to him, you know?
Yeah. And not only is he in a hearing taking an oath, like his story went further as well. I've heard about Dylan in UFO circles for about 2 years now.
Wow.
And someone that I know that works, you know, at the DOD, they said, yeah, like 2 years ago, we knew about him, but he didn't want to come forward. He was terrified and timid. And so it's taken him this long to like build up the courage to be like, okay, rip the Band-Aid off, let's go. He was further exposed to classified crash retrieval information through a special access program position that he was working for. So he had a high-level job, and just like Matthew Brown, he received spillage from a classified program that he shouldn't have. So he was able to kind of get an idea of what the US were doing and what they were studying. Colleagues of his that he was sharing this with were reporting similar treatment. They had their ability removed to be employed in the intelligence community. They were reported as misconduct in SAPs. They had their employment documents and clearances manipulated as well. So these people, you know, it might not be someone showing up at their house with a gun, though that has been talked about. I'll get onto that in a second. But like, this is really ruining someone's ability to just live and put food on the table and have a roof over their head. You know, like if every choice and everything you were doing had that possibility in front of you, you'd probably stop doing the thing that led you to that solution, yeah, or that conclusion, right? So these guys are stupidly brave.
Yeah, I think that's... I think that's a misconception a lot of the times, you know, amongst people that maybe are skeptical of the topic or don't believe people when they're saying these things. It's like they don't understand the ramifications that these people have when they come forward and tell these stories and how it negatively impacts them. Mm-hmm. And so it's really great to hear people like Dylan, you know, coming forward and sharing all of that additional detail about what has happened to him since, so that people can understand the reasons why people are reluctant to come forward. You know, there's always kind of that sensibility, yeah, of like, oh, they're just going to come forward and tell the story so they could sell books and like go on the circuit and, you know, be UFO famous or whatever. It's like, I think that's more of a curse than a blessing. You know?
Yeah, right. I love when I asked Richard Hatem in the interview, you know, do you want an experience? And he was like, hell no, no, it ruins people's lives. This isn't
exactly
something that I want to experience or have happen to me. I'm happy. I'm happily married. You know, it'll ruin my life.
Exactly. Exactly.
Just wanted to add, Weaponized did an interview with Matthew Brown, kind of reviewing the hearing. And in that, Matthew Brown revealed that the action that was taken against him, he got home with his family from being out, and someone had broken into the house, rearranged things on the table. So it was like really tidy and really obvious to show like, look, we had time to dig all this out and arrange it like this, and we haven't taken anything and no one caught us. But also they'd moved his father's ashes next to the bin. And so like there are implications there, you know, of the kind of thing that's being threatened there. And it's a very quiet one. You know, if I said, oh, you know, my mother's ashes were put there, someone would probably say, oh, you put them there and you forgot. But like combined and with all this other stuff, it's very easy to see why this was an unsettling to a major degree. Dylan, in March 2023, he decided he'd be a whistleblower and he reported with Arrow. He didn't share sources and methods with them out of worries that Arrow was compromised. He mentioned the phrase technologies of unknown origin, which about 2 years ago, I'd said to people, you know, keep watching this phrase, it's going to come up again. And here it was. This is how they do to get, it's the weasel language. They don't say UFO or UEP or any of these other phrases. It's just technology of unknown origin. And in that pile, you probably have some stuff from China and Russia and all these other countries. And it just lets you obfuscate. From Dylan's testimony, we can kind of take that the organization that whistleblowers have to go to, i.e. Arrow, isn't trustworthy. He didn't share sources and methods with them because he didn't have confidence. And we've heard from countless whistleblowers not to trust them. And he even goes on to say that he doesn't think that it was a foreign government. Knowing what I know now, I know it wasn't us, but Arrow has that answer and they could tell you what it is. But Arrow aren't. They're obfuscating. Every video they bring out is just balloons and they're not bringing out these anomalous things. So that kind of seems like, I guess, a bit of a honeypot. And yeah, Dylan says we can go to the stars or regress to the Stone Age with this technology. Your role as elected by representatives is to act on that info, and that time is now. I thought his testimony was really powerful. He delivered it in a really clear way. There was no fluff, and it was unsettling, I thought.
Mm-hmm. Big time. Didn't he get applause? Wasn't he the first person to get a round of applause? Was he?
I think he was. And he was certainly the first person in these hearings to get an apology from Luna, Rep Luna. That is, as far as I know, the first time in history that the government, you know, in a wishy-washy way, because it was just Luna, but a member of the government has apologized to a service member for how they've been treated for reporting a security concern.
Yeah. Wow. It's, I mean, even during his testimony, he mentioned, like, you know, when he saw the craft initially, that he didn't come forward then because he was warned against speaking out.
Yep.
Right. And so, and this, this happened to him how many years ago? Didn't he say 2013 or something?
Yeah, it was a while back now. And he, like I say, he's just been waiting in the wings.
Yeah, more than a decade later. And of course, now his, you know, I'm sure worst fears are coming true, which is kind of heartbreaking, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Nancy Mace, in the hearing, she said the line we were talking about, you know, last episode. If you don't know the program name, then you can't get the info. It is weasel language. This came up a whole bunch of times. You know, if someone's asking about ET, talk to them about ET. But if the DOD get a question of anomalous aircraft, why are they talking about ET at all? It's just, it's weird, you know. You said to someone, why'd you leave the car door open? And they went, I didn't leave the house unlocked all night last night. You'd be like, did you leave the house unlocked all night last night? Like, I think that's a natural reaction. We had Representative Crockett. She was new from the Democrats. I thought she was a bit of a firecracker. She correctly pointed out that, you know, 9/11 happened because different organizations weren't communicating and being transparent with each other. Do we want that to happen again? Obviously not. So these organizations need to start talking to each other. We had Tim Burchett with a good showing as well, I thought. He did
I love Tim
great.
Burchett. He's my fave.
And he brought up Lockheed as a contractor, saying that they were lying. And George Knapp said to him, he was like, hey, you know, we've got to remember with these people, they're not lying. They're doing their jobs as they're told to do them. They have pensions attached to that. If they don't do that, their lives are going to be ruined as well. So I think that's the subtlety we have to realize with this thing. Anyone in the program is there as a civil servant, and they are being told to do a job, and they are doing that job. Even the people testifying at these hearings are still doing their job. Otherwise, they would just, you know, be damned with a skiff talk and not care about what they say in a public hearing. But they would also be arrested, and the families would never see them again. There was Jeff Nucitelli pointed out that he followed up with Arrow to get more details on his sighting, see if anything came up. And Arrow told him that the records that he was citing had been destroyed, and that they'd been destroyed because there's a standard policy to destroy things after 3 years.
But
it just seems nuts.
What? Like, what? As soon as he said that in the hearing, both Dale and I were like, what? That makes no sense. So three years, every 3 years, they're destroying all police records off the base. Like, how does that make any sense?
And this was the same with Lou Elizondo's emails and things like that when John Greenwolf over the Black Vault tried to FOIA them. Sorry, they've been destroyed. It's our standard operating practice. Luckily, in that case, Lou had his own copies of the emails, but now there's nowhere to corroborate. Someone can just be like, oh, well, he's made something up and put it in the pile. And, you know, how convenient for the DOD that they do that. Borland said that Arrow went after all of the material and the staff members that he mentioned, and they classified everything to keep it behind lock and key. So there's a complete lack of transparency there. And then, you know, I think it's time to get onto the video. We won't show it. It's around.
You mean the moment, the culminating moment of the hearing? I'm pretty sure I was texting you about this, Dan, because I was watching it and you were, it was actually kind of crazy because I was watching it and you weren't. So I was giving you the scoop for a change.
So I'm just going to describe the video for the audio watchers because I guess we'll put a clip here for the video watchers. But basically, black and white video, one of those, you know, FLIR cameras like we're used to with this Tic Tac stuff. And there's an object kind of moving in the center of the frame. And then after a second, another object enters, which is a missile. It's a Hellfire missile. And it appears to hit the object kind of bounce off the side of it or ricochet off the side of it, at which point three objects come out of this main UFO and kind of hold position around it. So in the video, it looks like the UFO is still going forward and the objects are maintaining position around the UFO and moving with it. The Hellfire is out of frame at that point. Since then, I have learned that because obviously the shocking thing is like, whoa, the missile didn't explode. So there is a variant of this missile called the RX-9 Ginsu, which does not explode. It has blades and they pop out the side of it. So it shreds targets and they can kind of use it for more precision strikes. So when I found that out and I watched the video again, I was like, oh, okay, now this is looking more like a soft object to me. And I don't know what it is still. But, you know, it looks like it's being ripped as opposed to a hard impact there. So the bouncing off the object, I think, is probably that. That's what we're seeing. The objects that come out of it, we were told, you know, the object was moving at speed. These things followed it. But people have since found that there's actually kind of parallax at play here. And it's either a really slow moving object or a completely stationary object. And these things kind of fall out of it, or ejected out of it, or split off from it in damage. And the formation that they kind of maintain seems to be congruent with, you know, a balloon that's ripped to shreds and its payload is kind of shed and falling. So this is one of those videos that for me, you know, there's probably people listening to this going, it's not prosaic, Dan, don't do it. But I insist on being squarely in the middle with this. I don't know. There is no chain of custody for this video.
Well, that's an issue.
That right. came out afterwards, right? I was dead dropped and that it was shared. And so we don't know where it came from, who took it, whatever, you know. So the possibility that it's just a training exercise with a Hellfire missile remains. But also, it's a really weird video. And so once again, we need more information, I think, before we get emotional and attached to one explanation.
I mean, the weirdness for me was that the objects that split off from it all looked identical. So they all had like identical characteristics, all three of them, which is kind of weird. I mean, if you think about, like you said, a Ginsu, if you think about a missile hitting something and ripping it apart, you would think that the objects that it ripped apart would be irregularly shaped, you know, not look identical. So the fact that they all look the same is what really kind of did it for me in the non-prosaic camp. So I'm going to be the non-prosaic one on this, Stan. I am the Mulder to your Scully today.
Nice. I love it. I'm going to get a bob cut for my hair.
Oh my gosh, for the Halloween episode of The Signal.
Yeah, let's do it.
Let's do it.
We'll do that. Okay, so that's the cool video. More will come out on that. Apparently there's more footage from that clip and we don't really know. To your point, yeah, absolutely. I agree with that. They all look uniform. They all look the same. Perhaps it's the payload, something it was carrying underneath it or something like that, but we just don't know. And this is a problem because it kind of sucked all the air up after the hearing. And a lot of people kind of watch that. And depending on your bias, you might go, it's a balloon. You're all being ridiculous. And it kind of just takes the air out of the conversation. But this is the second time this has happened now, right? Like there was an event not too long ago with Lou Elizondo where he showed a photo. Mm-hmm. And in both of these instances, both people said, this is unvetted. I'm showing you because we need proper reporting channels for this. I don't know what it is. Then the community runs with it and gets excited, finds out that it's probably prosaic and the person's reputation is damaged. So at this point, you know, fool me once, fool me twice, fool me three times. I'm sat here with narrowed eyes going, is there someone taking advantage of this excitement in the community to just completely pull the rug?
That is such a dark take, Dan. That's unlike you. That's unlike you. Since when are you so suspect?
It's happened twice now. So I'm like that Futurama Fry gif, you know, just narrowing my eyes, just looking. Not completely married to it yet, but I'm suspicious.
Yes.
Especially after what we hear about Arrow and these repercussions and things like that.
Yeah.
But then the next bit, Luna said that she'd be happy to subpoena Mr. Kirkpatrick, who originally ran Arrow. I think that would be a good thing to do. That's our first bit of actionable stuff. Then George Knapp starts naming names. He names Dr. James Ryder at Lockheed, who apparently was the liaison for exchanging that material. Glenn Gaffney at the CIA. He was the director of science and technologies at the Office of Global Access in the CIA. So essentially, if there were crash retrieval programs in the CIA, he was in charge of them. So these people are named. Their names are out there now. We've heard them in community for a while. You know, Glenn Gaffney at the CIA was... He had the finger pointed to him by Chris Sharp at Liberation Times. And so, yeah, it's been around. But now they're out in public. I think that was great. Like, more like that, you know? Luna also said they'd be asking for immunity for Borland and others to testify in a skiff. And I think that's all the hearing stuff.
Is that all the hearing stuff?
Did you get the end of it? I think it is, yeah.
I mean, it was pretty meaty, I gotta say. Like, I actually watched it back last night just in, preparation for our chat today. Because the first time I watched it, I was working while I was watching it. So I was kind of a little bit torn. But, you know, watching it again last night, I was taken aback by how much depth there was to it. And I just as a closing thought, I love how riled up Burleson is getting.
Look, I'm not jumped to the conclusion that I believe that there are, you know, aliens coming from another planet. But I'm open to that. And I think that it's our responsibility, especially when we're seeing that we have a government that is blocking, actively blocking information from us. And I've had it. Enough is enough.
Yes. And he's taken in intelligence from everywhere as well. You know,
yes.
Like he's gone to see the mummies in Peru, and he's just mopping up information. It's the same as, you know, if you go on the CIA reading room, you can see they do a similar thing because their intelligence is the real world, and the real world has these things in it. So, yeah, they're kind of sucking all that up. So yeah, like by the end of this hearing, we're left with those actionable things as well. People that were named in the hearing, Lakatsky, Stratton, Kelleher, all from ORSAP, Kirkpatrick and the guys that run Arrow, Lockheed workers like James Ryder and Glenn Gaffney at the CIA. I think that is plenty of people to queue up probably two more hearings and get them on record.
Definitely.
But we also had some news from Canada as well.
Yeah, so you're saying, now you have to fill me in on this because I don't know what the Canada news is.
Yeah, for sure.
I feel like a bad Canadian right now.
So remember a few years back, the Chinese spy balloon?
Yes.
It was shot down. Yeah, it was like February 4th, 2023. Yes. And yeah, that was photographed by some people, Larry Mayer. He was like a Juno, he was taking photos. And anyway, like after this thing was found, NORAD opened their filters to see what else was in the airspace. And they identified a bunch more kind of objects that they spoke about in public. Many months later, through FOIA, someone found out that actually they'd had a lot more objects than they were telling us publicly. And had even encountered them over the course of the year. And the one that stood out to me was one that was labeled UAP-23. Not labeled 23 because it was in 2023, but because it was the 23rd encounter of a UAP that year. Canada have finally released FOIA documents kind of showing what they think it was, and they think it was a balloon. And that's fine. Like, I don't have a problem with that. Like, you know, one of them was a pink balloon. It is boring.
Boring.
It raises the question, why the hell was it a mystery in the first place? Why did they wait so long to release these files and just let everyone eat themselves and go into conspiracy theories, you know? It's just, it's really frustrating. But it's also good to see progress there. So well done, Canada. You've done more than the US has revealing things about the UAP shootdowns.
Right. I was going to say, also, Canada just tends to be really slow on this stuff, right? Like, you know, we talked last episode about how we finally have the Sky Canada project and they're, you know, actually kind of creating this task force to look into this stuff. I just feel like when it comes to, you know, putting things together in terms of what's in the sky and reporting on it and, you know, getting information out to the public, Canada is like 10 times slower than everywhere else. It just hasn't been a priority here. But I'm hoping that with the Sky Canada project, that will change a little bit. That's probably why I pay so little attention, Dan, to what is happening in Canada, because it feels like nothing ever happens here.
No, that's totally fair. There was also a hearing in Brazil where really... It was the kind of what you would expect. It was a lot of witnesses talking about things, secret programs in the past, like Operation Prato, which is Operation Saucer, which was the Colaris incident, where a bunch of people were like burned by UFOs and stuff. There are some incredible documentaries out there. James Fox covers that case, so I highly recommend going to see them. Yeah. But yeah, people are calling for transparency. all over the world. And in the Brazilian hearing, they directly cited the US's influence on their decision to have this hearing. So again, the more we talk about it, the more we're talking about it. I think that's important.
There you go.
So we have looked at the lawman beating up the wrong guy. And now it's time to ask, is there life on Mars, Roz?
Ooh, my favorite David Bowie song of all time. Obviously.
Absolutely. So what happened was NASA's Perseverance rover has discovered a kind of mudstone rock formation in Mars's Jezero crater that they think contains organic compounds and minerals like iron phosphates and sulfides, whose patterns hint at chemical reactions possibly linked to ancient life. They haven't found a Martian, but they found a footprint from a Martian, maybe.
Yeah.
But we're talking microbial. It doesn't prove that life existed, but they strengthen the case that the Jezero crater and Mars was once habitable. And their next step now is that the rover has cached a core sample from that region, and it's going to be bringing it back to Earth for further lab analysis to confirm whether, you know, the mineral organic patterns are biotic or abiotic in origin, life or not life, basically. What do you think, Roz? Is
it
exciting or like science? Tell me the result. Like, where are you with this?
I was really excited to see that NASA was coming forward and just saying, like, you know, I would say like fairly unequivocally, like, we found life on Mars. I mean, they really did step forward with that as the main headline, right? Of course, there's always the caveat somewhere in there of, oh, well, we have to test it when we get it back and make sure that what we're seeing is what we think we're seeing. But they all seemed very excited about this discovery, you know, which leads me to believe that they're for sure on the right track. It's kind of a weird thing, right? Where it's just a bunch of patterns on a rock. It's like a bunch of little, you know, like kind of
like a
growths,
lichen.
Like a, exactly. Like a moss. Like kind of a substance or something like that, which is, but yeah, I mean, I think it's just the confirmation we've all been waiting for, right? Like, I feel like for decades we've known that something has been happening on Mars and that there was water there and that potentially there was life there. So I feel like it was just a matter of time until they found something. So yeah, this just, again, confirms for me that, you know, David Bowie was on the right track all those years ago.
Asking the question early. Yes. An awesome song.
Yes.
And it brings up the idea, you know, we ask, is this life? But we don't really talk about the fact that we don't know what life is. Like, we've had so many definitions for it across the ages. And when you look at like everything from our common ancestor or our lost universal common ancestor, or LUCA for short, we've named it. That was like 3.5 billion years ago on Earth. We don't know where it came from. If it was panspermia, directed panspermia, like we just don't know. Life started here somehow. And searching on other planets is informing us how life began on Earth, where we come from, but also about the cosmos and what's possible out there. We used to think there were no planets aside from us. And now I think we counted our 6,000th exoplanet the other day.
That's wild.
And so our universe is getting bigger and more crowded. And I think if we were to find life on Mars or a sign of life in the past on Mars, it starts raising these questions of, okay, well, where else is it? And then closer to home, we always also have the, you know, the debate of viruses, if viruses are alive. You know, you make a drug, you attack the virus changes and adapts and keeps attacking. That's like a call and response. And because we don't have a definition for life, we can't say whether it's alive or not. We just argue over whether it is. And I just wanted to touch on just how that kind of has changed through the ages. So in the 1500s, we had René Descartes, who thought of life as a mechanism. It was called dualism, and it was all about the mind versus the body. Like, we're a machine, essentially. Then we move into what's called vitalism in the 17th and 19th centuries, which is like life is a special force, that it needs something else to make this spark, to create life. Then we hit the 19th century, and it becomes life as organization, where we're just discovering kind of cells and cell theory and Darwinian evolution towards the end of the 1800s. And so we're thinking about life as an organism, as an organism that is an organized system of cells and self-replicating and evolves over time. It kind of became unnecessary because, like I said, this is where early science is happening. We move into the 20th century, where we get biochemistry and genetics, and we get the discovery of DNA and the central kind of dogma of molecular biology. And we start thinking of life as information processing and chemical reactions. Like, we've moved so far from just body and mind at this point, right? We're talking about all these little tiny things that make us up. Then we hit further in the 20th century, kind of late 20th, where we're talking about systems and complexity, that life as systems and networks with like metabolism, feedback loops, self-organization. And so we had Ludwig von Bertin, I'm going to mess this name up now, Bertalanffy, who came up with something called the general systems theory, and Stuart Kaufman, which is all about, his work was all about the complexity of the body and self-organization. So by this point, the body isn't this static thing anymore that's just a machine, like you have your mind and your body. It's a dynamic process. And so this is where we start getting into questions of like, well, what is death? You know, your whole body doesn't die at the same time. I can die and parts of my body can still be functional. So the line between life and death is really kind of wishy-washy. And then we get to contemporary views, which is kind of life as a continuum, that it's increasingly defined by functionality rather than ontology. So we're looking at metabolism, homeostasis, which is like maintaining internal stability, reproduction, like the ability to propagate yourself, information storage and transmission, like obviously that's DNA, RNA, or equivalent in other life. They're the only two we know, but there's probably more out there. And then we also have evolution and adaptation and changing over generations. And that's pretty much where we currently are, where, you know, we have extremophiles and artificial life and synthetic cells that no longer fit into this idea of what we think of as life in a contemporary sense. So we're still being challenged to kind of go, the box that you've put life in isn't good enough, like it's too restricting. And so looking at this stuff on Mars, it starts pulling us out of that box, right? Like we're looking at not life as we know it, which is where science works from, but we're starting to think about life as we don't know it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, I think too, when you look at just the Earth and we look at things like octopus, for example, you know, we come to realize that, you know, life is far more complex and can be even smarter than us in so many ways, in ways that are just completely alien and foreign to us. And, you know, even understanding the complex ecology of our own oceans, right? Which will be a future episode for us with Dr. Fornay, right? You know, there's just so much complexity that we don't even understand in our own oceans. So, you know, it's interesting to see that, they're discovering these things on Mars, and it is expanding, like you say, our thoughts around what is life, what constitutes life, and what do we qualify as that, right?
Yeah. It's cool. An important question. You know, NASA had a mission in, I think it was like 76, I want to say. Yeah, 76. It was the Viking 1 and 2 missions that went to Mars. And they were set up to look for life. And they found something. And it's been controversial ever since. Like, you can Google it. And people are arguing over whether it's life or whether it's not. The scientists, there were peer-reviewed studies produced that went either way. And they couldn't decide. Because when they tested the sample that they found, they destroyed it. Because the definition of life that they were working with said that it should have survived, and actually we found that it wouldn't have, and we killed whatever we found. So we're not alone. We just killed the thing when we found out we weren't alone. Relevant, thinking about how they fire Hellfire missiles at potential UFOs, I guess.
Sure.
But it's crazy that that happened, and now, 75, so ages after, we're finally getting to look again with a more modern idea of what life is. And we still might not get it right. You know, like...
Yeah.
Like, exactly like you said, there's a great movie called Annihilation, where the...
Is Natalie Portman in that?
Yes.
Yes. So good.
It's really so good. It's a great series of books too. If you like the weirdness of it, they go much harder in the books.
Yep.
But it's just something that escapes us defining it, of kind of going, that's a life form, because it's just so weird. It's this thing called the shimmer that lands on the planet, and it just infects and changes things. Mm-hmm. And it's more like, a cancer, but it's not necessarily changing things into a bad way. It's just changing things. And we don't really know how to deal with that, because we're just so used to putting things in boxes.
Yeah, that's right. I think too about like tardigrades, right? water bears. You know, they're like floating around and all these weird little, like, what is it, like in the heat in the bottoms of the ocean? Is that where they're kind of popping up? Finding them in these extreme environments, right, where we would have never considered that life could exist, right? Yeah. So, yeah, it seems like the more we look, and this is kind of the weird thing with physics too, right? It's like the more we look at things, the more we discover. The deeper we look, the more we find. And in some ways, the deeper we look, the less we find, which is maybe even a little more disturbing, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah. And now, Dan, it's time for...
Drum roll, please. UFO or UFNO, the solution. There were a bunch of things just for listeners that we didn't get to today, but we'll put them into the next episode because we always like to try and keep this to a tight, like 1 hour 10 around there because people are busy, you
know? That's right, us included. And we have too much to talk about, Dan. There's just way too much, okay? I have way too many thoughts. Okay, we didn't even get to the book club. We got to get to the book club.
No.
Okay, that's next episode. We're starting the next episode with that. Okay, so let me just pull this up. I'm going to share. Mm-hmm.
We're going to look at the solution for this UFO or UFNO video, and there is a solution.
Okay.
Upon taking that video and watching it, I approached, and basically there was this tiny little thing on the edge of the cliff where you could stand, and it just didn't look like you could even get there. But there was this guy stood there with a fishing pole that had two lights on it. So when the lights were moved around in the pitch black, what was actually happening is he was slinging his line out. From where I was standing, it looked like these crazy lights were moving 90-degree turns real fast over the ocean. And so it's a little bit of trickery, which is why I wanted to show this video, because it's a cool video, but at the same time, it's prosaic.
Why is he doing that? Why is he doing that? I'm so mad at that person right now. Okay.
They have the lights, I think, to help them see so that they don't hit each other with the rods and stuff. If you're a fisherman, let us know why you have the lights on the end of your rods. Because, again, another
Seriously, he has seriously irritated your co-host, Dan, whoever this person is. I'm not impressed.
The fisherman here would always irritate me. They pour all this stuff all over the path and stuff. So I don't mind you being irritated as well. But yeah, it is. Those lights, those crazy lights in that pitch black video were actually lights on the end of a fishing rod.
Okay, I feel very sad about this. I feel very sad about this. That is the biggest letdown. Oh man, how are we going to end this on an up note?
Well, learning's fun, and now we can investigate, right? Like, I was really satisfied when I found this solution, because I went from going, what the hell is that? Oh my God, I've got a cool UFO video, to, oh, okay, that's what it was. And sure, it's really boring, but I was like, I'm going to do something with this in the future and show it to people, because it's this easy to be tricked, you know? I was there filming, trying to investigate it, and for a split second, I thought that was something anomalous.
It totally got me. It totally got me. I have to redeem myself. I'm not even sure how I'm going to redeem myself. I was so certain off the top of the show that that was a UFO. Okay.
Well, how is this? You choose the next one.
Okay.
For our next episode. And you can either crush my spirits or, you know, make me very happy with a UFO video.
Okay, deal. But does it have to have a solution? That's the thing.
It doesn't, no. It can just be an unknown, and that's okay as well. But I like doing the ones with solutions because they're learning opportunities and stuff. And it just goes to show you that you can be tricked. But it also emphasizes that just because you see something that's prosaic, it doesn't mean that all the lights in the sky are prosaic. We've got to keep looking at these things on a case-by-case basis. Yes. I was pleased I solved that one.
Yes. I guess anytime we have a solution, that means it's a UFNO.
Right, exactly. So that is a UFNO. We've done two UFNOs in a row next, so feel free to go another direction if you want to, but I shall leave it in your capable hands.
All right, you're on. I'm on the hunt now. Actually, I already know the video.
Oh,
so
okay.
I'm ready. Cool. Nice. I'm already ready.
I look forward to it.
Okay, awesome. All right, Dan, well, that's it. End of episode 2. We're the signal episode 2. This is officially like episode 4 of the show, I think. So congratulations, first 4 episodes.
Congratulations to you too, and to anyone listening, I think, maybe, I don't know, they might think they wasted their time after the fisherman reveal, but thank you for being with us. Either way, we really appreciate it. Thank you for the warm welcome to the community. Yes. Can't wait to show you what we've got kind of coming up. I think our next interview is going to be with Maya. Is that right? Anthropologist.
I believe so. Yes.
So you're going to hear from an anthropologist talking about, you know, indigenous cultures, how politics changes knowledge and how we kind of gather facts, and also how we can look to indigenous communities for kind of guidance when we are dealing with these really out there things. But if you enjoyed this episode, please, it would be awesome if you wouldn't mind leaving a review on Spotify or whatever platform you're on. We are on a lot more platforms now. There are a bunch of tick boxes that were hidden, but we've done it. If you could like, share, or subscribe, you know, send this to your mom. See what she thinks. A lot of the awesome feedback is coming from people who are very casual and are enjoying our kind of, you know, quick fire.
Chill vibe.
Yeah. If you'd like to support the show and get access to a 1-hour live chat each month and early ad-free access, you can find us at Patreon. Just follow the link in the show notes or go to our website, tobehumanshow.com. And please feel free to reach out to us as well with like questions or sharing your witness stories. And we might even feature you on a future episode if you fancy it. Don't worry, it's not going to be video. It's just audio only. So you don't have to be terrified of cameras. It's all good. You'll just be talking to me and we'll be chill. It's all good. You're in a safe space. But you can send us a video email at hello@tobehumanshow.com. You can also find us on Blue Sky, Threads, Instagram, or X at tobehumanshow. But all I ask of everyone is to always remember to be curious, because the universe is bigger than you know.
What It Means to Be Human is a Double Barrel production. This week's episode was produced by Roz Mugford and Dan Zetterstrom. Sound post-production by Parker Mosley, with technical support from Dale Mugford. Our theme music is by Thunderbird.